Chapter 18. Lotus Feet. Soon after returning from my fourth trip to India, I began working with the Sri Satya Sai Baba Book Center of America, which is engaged in reprinting and distributing Baba's teachings. Finding there to be a dearth of such material by Westerners, I began writing this book in February 1974. The following October, my brother Donald decided to visit Baba again. I had completed enough of the book by this time to present it to Baba and ask his direction, so I decided to join Don. I had felt all along that the book would meet with his approval, and that, in fact, he was giving me direction the whole time, but I wasn't really sure. I began to worry. How will he receive me? Will he recognize the book as a devotional piece to him? Will he accept it as a manifestation of the deepest yearnings of my heart to be close to him? Will he tell me to go ahead with it, that he is pleased? Or will he tell me to burn it? We left on December 6th. This fifth time, I could no longer ignore a certain amount of guilt about leaving my wife and family so much over the past 3 years. Thank God that Sharon had had a strong and unique experience with Baba herself. They had led her to her own deepening relationship with him and had given her insight into my increased involvement. The changes and pressures in our marriage had been great, and although Sharon accepted and supported my direction in life now, this had not come about without a good bit of pain and hardship. I remembered with a smile what must have been her initial impression of me when I returned from the first trip. I had left a contemporary, free-thinking psychiatrist and returned in a condition comparable to being tattered, covered with ashes, muttering incomprehensible Sanskrit words, and asking everyone in the area to join in singing devotional songs to the Lord. She had witnessed my jumping from bed before dawn to sit still as a lamppost in meditation. Add to this, teachers calling her concerning strange stories told by our children about a man who could take gifts out of thin air, and the concern of relatives who perceived the change as a defiant rejection of my own past and religion. Then there was the continual influx into our lives of Baba devotees from all walks of life, bearded and barefoot or straight-laced, with all that this entailed in the way of bhajan groups, study groups, and incessant talk of God. On top of this, my returning to India time and again, my lately becoming immersed in a book which frequently took me from family activities, and now running back to India for the fifth time. Fortunately, Sharon's first experience with Baba had been so moving that it and subsequent experiences had sealed a bond in her relationship with him, giving her the strength to cope with all these changes. At our first meeting, Indra Devi had shown some films of Sai Baba. At one point, I noticed Sharon suddenly became excited and began to move about restlessly in her chair. I wondered what had happened, but said nothing and continued to watch the film. Finally, she blurted out, quote, "Indra Devi, when is Sai Baba's birthday?" Unquote. "November 23rd, was the answer. Sharon was electrified. Not only was this the same date as her own, but somehow she had absolutely known that she and Baba shared the same birthday. We were both quite surprised because Sharon had never demonstrated any clairvoyant or precognitive abilities before. This was the first of a number of experiences. On another occasion, just before she was about to leave with me on her first trip to India, and at a time when she was greatly afraid of flying, Sharon was driving home from the supermarket, her thoughts quite apart from Sai Baba or the trip. Suddenly, she became aware of a strong scent of vibhuti, which lingered in the car for several minutes. The experience was accompanied by an eerie sense of Baba's presence, a presence she continued to feel and which actually helped her through the difficulties of the trip. Then, one evening, some weeks after our return, Sharon and the children were talking in our living room about Sai Baba. Was he really real? They wanted to know. I think he's real. I saw him do some amazing things, Sharon said. I don't know if he's real, one of the children answered hesitantly. At that very moment, a large picture of Baba suddenly crashed to the floor from a nearby table, stunning everyone. Then, in awed whispers, they began to affirm, he must be real. Subsequently, Sharon has had 5 or 6 dreams in which she is with Baba and is being taught by him. She asks questions, and he responds with such love and warmth that she has felt a lasting glow from the dreams. She considers them far more than her mind's imagination. They have been invaluable in helping her reconcile Sai Baba's increasing influence in our lives with her Jewish upbringing. Although initially Sharon had reacted to the intensity of my enthusiasm, perhaps her greatest distress had come from observing the proliferation of Baba's photographs throughout the house. Since in the Hebrew tradition it is taboo to worship a human as divine, she was uncomfortable when her Jewish friends and relatives came to our home and saw such an array. The conflict between Baba and Judaism was gradually resolved, however, as Sharon began to discover the universality in Baba's message. When she learned that he encourages people to follow their own familiar religion and teaches that since God is behind all names and forms, everything is a manifestation of God. Any form can be used for the focus of worship if it symbolizes divinity for the devotee. Baba says, worship God as the picture, but not the picture as God. He says, quote, the Lord can be addressed by any name that tastes sweet to your tongue, or pictured in any form that appeals to your sense of wonder and awe. You can sing of him as Muruga, Ganapati, Sharada, Jesus, Maitreyi, Shakti, or you can call on Allah, or the formless, or the master of all forms. It makes no difference at all. He is the beginning, the middle, and the end, the basis, the substance, and the source. This universal appeal is seen at Prashanti Nilayam, for here one enters a mysterious and marvelous world where people from all faiths and all walks of life, from every imaginable social position, are undergoing profound internal changes together, being molded into a brotherhood of spiritual aspirants. The varieties of people drawn to Baba and their stories are remarkable. On the 5th trip, for example, I met a Buddhist monk from Sri Lanka, Ceylon, who is the head of a Buddhist monastery, 2 Christian medical students from England, a Sikh from the Punjab of northern India, Europeans, Nepalese, Japanese, and Africans, all with miraculous stories that send one's head reeling. Sharon gradually started witnessing changes inside herself, which began to turn her more strongly toward Baba. She found herself beginning to enjoy opening our home for religious activities. In the process of giving to people, she was receiving much more than she had anticipated. She began to experience greater calm and a new feeling of joyfulness in her life, and witnessed her long-standing fear of death subside. But perhaps her greatest joy, she told me when we worked together on this part of the book, came from seeing her husband become a more giving, loving, and contented person. As for our four lovely daughters, children have a beautiful, apparently innate grasp of the spiritual. Whether because of their dependent relationship with parents or because, as Wordsworth said, they have just come from God, quote, trailing clouds of glory, unquote, it seems entirely natural to them that there should be a loving God with whom to relate. The innocence and sincerity with which they sing spiritual songs and say prayers is heartwarming. There seems such direct communication between little ones and God. Sharon and I felt initially that conflicts might arise in teaching the children both about Sai Baba and Judaism, but we haven't found this to be true. Their questions can be answered from either or both spiritual orientations. This has been proved a living example to us of the one truth inherent in all religions. Such were my thoughts on boarding the plane this fifth time. I felt deep love and gratitude for the freedom Sharon was allowing me in making this trip while she stayed home with the children. And I recognized that although there might still be some trying times along this path, the dimension it added to all of our lives more than outweighed the inconveniences and hardships it entailed. I left knowing that Sharon felt Baba's entrance into our lives had been a profound blessing, that through this contact, our lives were being filled with greater meaning and love. The sun on this beautifully clear, cool Sunday was warm and rejuvenating. About 1,000 people were gathered here on the grounds of Vrindavan, with Don and myself sitting on the edge of the crowd. After 40 hours of traveling and very little sleep, it felt good just to sit there and soak up the sun's energy, anticipating Baba's appearance. Then suddenly, the figure in orange emerged. I kind of gauged the spiritual work I've done between trips now by my reaction on first seeing that orange robe. It's gotten so I have no control at all anymore. Suddenly I start shaking all over and experiencing inner reactions that I feel at no other time. I wonder, my God, am I turning into some kind of hysteric? All I can do is just sit there and hope no one is watching me. At least I felt less conspicuous sitting as far back as we were. As Baba approached us, he raised his hand in a sign of recognition and greeting and flashed the sweetest smile one could imagine. A glance and a wave of his hand, and I just fell apart. Everyone else started running after him, and all I could do was sit there for half an hour trying to regain my composure. Later, Indra Devi came out and notified us that we would have an interview the next morning. I began to wonder. It's one thing to be in San Diego theorizing about Baba's omnipresence and omniscience, but quite another to sit next to him and, when the cards are on the table, say, "Look, I wrote a book about you and wonder what you think of it." when one has all this yearning to give everything one has, surrender everything to the divine, it's always nice if the divine is really there to take it. If you come up to Baba wanting to spill out your heart, and he says, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" that smarts a bit. But when the circuit is completed and the love is accepted and returned, the joy and fulfillment are overwhelming. We had been invited in for a group interview. Baba spoke with clear and simple eloquence for an hour. Then I stood up. "Swami, can I see you about the book I have written?" Gently taking my hand, he led me into a private room. "Okay, what do you want?" he asked. I began to shake. Oh my goodness, this reaction again, will I be able to handle myself? I took out my manuscript and began fumbling through an explanation, not making myself at all clear. "Does he really know?" I thought. "Or am I just looking foolish?" "I have this book that I just wrote about you, Baba," I said. When one gets close to him, there is a side that looks so human, as limited and fallible as anyone else. And I was now wondering seriously whether he even understood what I was saying. He looked questioningly at me, so I made another attempt to explain. I was beginning to feel completely misunderstood. Then he looked up smilingly and with a knowing eye said, quote, "Fine, you come back on Thursday and we will talk for an hour on all the specifics of the book. Dr. Gokak will be there, and you bring your brother too," end quote. "Okay," I said, stunned. I walked in some confusion back to the group, and again, all I could do was sit on the floor for some time to regain my composure. I'm still amazed to witness myself break up like this, although I've heard that many people have such reactions as they draw closer to Baba. The tears just well up, and the heart goes out, and it seems the closer I get, the less control I have. Baba gave the book to Dr. Gokak to read. Under Baba's supervision, he heads the Satya Sai Baba Educational Foundation and administers the Summer School for Spirituality and Indian Culture. As we study the book together the next few days, one of his comments proved to be quite an eye-opener for me. "So much is written about India's poverty, especially by Westerners accustomed to material comforts. Frequently, they point to it in a critical manner, with no thought that the West is in any way responsible. Dr. Gokak assured me that the Indians abhor this sense of poverty and broken spirit and have initiated a number of far-reaching programs to deal with it. But he stated that the West must not refuse its share of responsibility for helping to create it in the first place. Until about the 16th century, according to Dr. Gokak, the East and West were on about the same material level. But as the West began to gain knowledge of the physical world from its burgeoning new science, it guarded and refused to share it," he said, "gradually becoming wealthy at the expense of those countries without technological know-how. These countries were used as resource suppliers, literally being bled dry. The other side of the coin of Western material wealth and power has been the poverty and subjugation of many peoples. A story told to me by a number of educated Indians was very moving, expressing the hurt which must lie deep in the Indian psyche. A group of weavers in Dhaka, now in Pakistan, had developed the weaving of beautiful muslin cloth into an extremely refined art, passed from generation to generation within families. These artists in cloth grew long fingernails, beneath which they placed delicate wheels as part of their technique in weaving. Unfortunately, this fine cloth woven with such exquisite care was competing with cloth made in the West. Therefore, I was told, the English cut off the fingers of the weavers in Dhaka. Yes, it is easy for us Westerners to point to the East and say, look what a mess they've gotten themselves into. Why don't their gurus take care of them? But it is becoming increasingly apparent to me that everything is interconnected on this globe, and we all share responsibility for the suffering in the world. The day of the interview came. There were 9 of us present, including 2 young medical students from England, 2 other Americans from Los Angeles, and an elderly Indian woman whom Baba introduced as one of the first politically active women in India, who had done much to help in India's fight for independence. Sitting there, rocking to a gentle inner rhythm, he began to speak his words of love. He is always the same. Most of us dwell in a reality shaped by the elusive transient nature of our minds, fashioned by our desires and wants. Thus, for most of us, reality is constantly changing. When we are awake, one set of circumstances appears real. When we are dreamlessly asleep, another set. When we are dreaming, still another. We perceive reality differently according to our age as well. A child sees one reality, the adolescent another, the mature and then aged and dying adult still others. It is not reality that is changing, of course, but our state of mind. Is reality, then, just a manifestation of the mind? Or is there a degree or level of reality that never changes, a reality separate from our mind's distracting creations? Can we be centered someplace, or perhaps more correctly, all places, where our experience is the same, no matter whether we are asleep or awake, dreaming or not, at any age, at any time in our lives? Are we capable of realizing a changeless, timeless reality, where all is one and all is the same, where there is no difference between past, present, and future, and where one is in constant touch with his immortality, immutability, and infinite capacity, his ultimate identity with the divine? Sai Baba's sameness is convincing evidence of such a reality. I used to wonder what would bring thousands of people, sometimes traveling for weeks on end, over great distances and often overwhelming obstacles, to come and sit at the side of the road in the scorching Indian sun just for a glimpse of a holy man. The secret has been revealed to me by witnessing such a vision myself. There is a unique quality, an incredibly subtle vibration, which, when sensed, speaks with absolute conviction of the glorious and eternal moment man is capable of attaining. When people speak of materializations, and all the other yogic or paranormal or psychic powers, they refer to the tip of an iceberg whose full magnificence can often be measured best by one quick glimpse of the Master. This is really the great blessing of darshan, the soul's conviction that one is visualizing the form and embodiment of the divine, is a gift that has sent millions into a life of devotion. To my delight, as Baba began to address the nine of us at the interview, he focused on the book. For 15 minutes, he enveloped me in his marvelous aura of energy, answering all my prayers, assuring me that the circuit had been completed, and he was receiving my offering in a way I could never have imagined. He spoke about the purpose and meaning of the book as I had visualized it, and in a way which convinced me that he understood and accepted it. Finally, regarding me with love and gentleness, he said, quote, "I am satisfied," end quote. Then he looked into each of our eyes with an almost mischievous smile and added, quote, "And I haven't even read this book yet," end quote. I cracked up. The relief from tension was enormous. During this trip, as with the others, I continued to be treated to the most extraordinary stories about Baba by people from every walk of life. One such story came from Dr. S. Ramakrishna, the son of Dr. S. Bhagavantam, whom I have already mentioned. Ramakrishna grew up in the scientific tradition like his father, has a PhD in engineering, and is a professor of aeronautical engineering at the Indian Institute of Sciences in Bangalore. He related an incident which occurred some years ago when he was 23. One day, he and four of his friends were riding in the country with Baba. It was about noon, and everyone was thinking of lunch. Baba called a halt and asked the group what kind of fruit they liked. Suspecting that something unusual might occur, they decided in unspoken agreement that each should pick something different. One picked a mango, another an apple, another one an orange, and so on. Baba smiled and listened patiently, then, according to Ramakrishna, motioned them to a small tree by the side of the road and told them to pick the fruits they had chosen. To their utter amazement, dangling from the branches were the very five fruits they had chosen, each on its own stem. Dr. Ramakrishna looked straight into my eyes and smiled. One evening, Baba called six of us in for an interview and directed us to ready ourselves to leave with him early the next morning. We would take a cab a mile out of Puttaparthi at about 5 o'clock and wait for him. He said, quote, "This will be your good chance. I am leaving for Vrindavan, and you will ride behind me. It is my intention that you may ride in my car with me part of the way," end quote. We were so excited. "Mum's the word, don't tell a soul," we all agreed, since we knew that whenever Baba travels, he is followed by swarms of people. We secretly mapped out our strategy and were quite sure we could execute the plan without giving ourselves away. The next morning, Don began letting the air out of his air mattress at about 1:30. "Not yet," I whispered. By 3:30, unable to wait any longer, we got up and moved stealthily about, quietly brushing our teeth, tiptoeing, luggage in hand, to our taxi. Waiting there, packed to the hilt, with the motors warming up, were 10 other taxis, and what seemed like 500 people gathered about. It was uncanny. How did they find out? Foiled again. We waited at the designated spot outside Puttaparthi, but when Baba came by, we were left in a cloud of dust. We couldn't even see his car. There were so many people ahead of us. The next day, Thursday, Baba invited some 20 Americans in for another interview. After producing some vibhuti, he materialized little medals for the children present. These would protect them in time of danger, he said, by sending a message to him so that he could respond instantaneously. Then he moved his hand in the air, and as I was watching, where there was nothing, suddenly there was a large ball of rock candy, about 3 inches in diameter. He cracked some of it and gave it to the children. Then turning to me, he said that the rest was for my wife and children and Don and his family, and that he would give us something more for the children later. The candy was quite tasty. Thursday is a day when bhajans are sung continuously and Baba appears twice for darshan. He had told Don and me in our personal interview that we were going to get a ride in his car after all. By 4:30, we began waiting for him at the gate to the inner grounds of the ashram. He appeared at about 5 o'clock, and as he passed, motioned us to his car, then went out to the 1,000 or so devotees gathered for darshan. Before long, we were driving down the driveway through the outer ashram grounds to the street. As we made our way slowly through the grounds, I witnessed something I could not have imagined in my wildest dreams. This huge wave of humanity, hearts open, faces filled with yearning, enveloped the car, focusing energy on it with an intensity that was almost unbearable. The memory of one of my first encounters with Baba suddenly struck me when I was watching him from outside the stadium in Bombay. Then I had been one of thousands with Baba in the center. Now here I was at the center myself, sitting next to him. I can't begin to fully convey the experience. I felt terribly conspicuous and wanted to shrink to the floor. The incident introduced a new dimension in my relationship with Baba. He says one should attend to spiritual practice and devotional work in the faith that one is drawing closer to the Lord. I was beginning to experience this movement in a very concrete way. So many of us think our lives are long and without movement, that we are going nowhere. Perhaps we are bored. Time is dragging and nothing is happening. In reality, we are hurtling through the space and time of our lives at breakneck speed. It is at a time like this, as I concretely witness myself drawing within 3 years from the periphery to the center, that I know this to be true. We do shape our destiny. We do make movement. We can draw closer to the divine. Baba says, quote, "You must grow day by day, not only physically, but in the spiritual life also. How long are you staying on in the primary school, writing down the alphabet? Get up, demand an examination, pass, and move forward to the higher class." End quote. With regard to our responsibility in directing ourselves Along this path, Baba writes, quote, God is not involved in either rewards or punishments. He only reflects, resounds, and reacts. He is the eternal, unaffected witness. You decide your own fate. Do good, be good, and you get good in return. Be bad, do bad deeds, you reap bad results. Do not thank or blame God. Thank yourself. Blame yourself. End quote. Baba was allowing me to feel the movement closer to the center. Here he was. No self-consciousness, no awkwardness, smiling and waving, appearing fully merged with his devotees. I turned to gaze at him and was suddenly enveloped in his bliss myself, caught up in his love in a way which melted all self-consciousness. Then he looked over at my brother, and with an impish smile, his eyes just twinkling, he said, quote, "All the Americans are very jealous. I don't know why." End quote. That just cracked me up. Baba can be so mischievous sometimes in intensifying the fire of the ego, bringing out its impurities and jealousies so they can be seen and transcended. He seems to play his role as its destroyer, as part of a great game. Many people have told me they feel that Baba in no small measure seems to set up one ego, one faction, one quarrel after another. What a thrill to experience Baba's personality so closely during this drive. He seemed so human, so fallible, being with us at our level to allow us to become friendly and familiar with him. The experience of being permitted to witness the avatar as friend is described beautifully in the Bhagavad Gita, in the relationship between Arjuna and Krishna. Arjuna much preferred being a friend to Krishna to being fully aware of all of his power and glory. At one point in chapter 11, Arjuna asked to see Krishna's full reality and glory. And the vision was at once so glorious and terrifying that Arjuna was completely overwhelmed and pleaded for Krishna to return to his familiar, limited form. In an interview with the American spiritual newspaper The Movement in October 1974, during his visit to the United States, Dr. Gokak commented on this special relationship as follows. Interviewer, it must be strange at times relating to Baba, being so close to him and knowing him. How do you relate to him? As a friend or as a vehicle for God to come through this shell called Sai Baba? How do you relate to that situation? Dr. Gokak, he's the friend I love, the God I fear, and Krishna, at whose enigmatic hands I love to be slain, making myself immortal. This is how I relate to him. I am prepared for everything, for my doing, for my undoing, for all that. And I am also prepared for the human relationship. In the morning, when I'm in the next room and the avatar walks in and says, "Do you have a shaving brush?" I give him mine because he has forgotten his own. I relate to him in this way also. He is so intensely human. He can be so divine. Interviewer: Does this seem like a paradox to you? Dr. Gocock: No. Even when I am aware of all that he stands for, when I am near him and he cuts jokes with me, I forget all that he is and I begin to talk as a friend. It is only when I get away from him and come to America, for example, and see what is happening to him in all these homes, with all these photographs everywhere, that I say, is this the Baba with whom I'm staying? I begin to experience a sense of awe. Once I said to him, when will you show me your cosmic form? He said, wait, wait, I will show you. He said, why do you think I have taken you so close to me? For that reason, I have taken you close. But actually, I don't know what else he is going to show but what I have seen already. When I am near him, I still forget that he is Baba. I think of him as very great and all that, and near to me. I can take liberties and joke now and then, when he smiles, not otherwise. But then I forget the rest of it. When I go to other places and see Vibhuti showering in photographs and images appearing from nowhere, people going into ecstasy repeating his name, then I say, yes, this is the cosmic form. End interview in the movement. And so I too was being allowed closer contact with the personality. As we started our drive, Baba leaned forward, resting his elbow on the back of the front seat. His actions were animated, and he appeared to be in a joking mood. I like to make jokes, he said. Turning to the young driver of the car, he began to chide him playfully to drive more slowly. He was the epitome of the nagging backseat driver. Slower, 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 he kept demanding until the poor fellow was driving about 5 miles an hour. To the left, over more to the left, smiling all the way. Cars drive on the left side of the road in India. A small rickety car passed to our right. I like small cars, he commented. Then he began to talk about our families and our marriages. I'll give something to the children. And then he materialized 6 postage stamp-sized pictures. For part of the ride, he appeared to be thinking, relaxing and unwinding from a busy day. But he wasn't still for long. His speech and movements became quick, at times almost staccato. He kept up a steady stream of conversation in a casual, friendly tone that put us at ease. Partway through the drive, Baba directed the driver to stop and invited us out for a walk. In a few minutes, we were walking along the side of the road like old friends. The sun was setting, and the western sky was a radiant orange fan. Far down the road behind us, we could see headlights approaching. Quote, you men surround me, and we will walk in this fashion so that no one can see me, because if that is a bus and they see me, they will stop and put an end to our walk. End quote. I was momentarily taken aback by Baba's instructions, having been put at such ease in his presence that I had almost forgotten his immense stature and popularity. Then I reminded myself that, after all, here I was with an avatar. He was simply saying what is true. The following quotation is from Satya Sai Baba, quote, "In truth, you cannot understand the nature of my reality, either today or even after 1,000 years of steady austerity or ardent inquiry, even if all mankind joins in the effort. But in a short time, you will become cognizant of the bliss showered by divine principle, which has taken upon itself this sacred body and this sacred name. Your good fortune, which will provide you this chance, is greater than what was available for monks, sages, saints, and even personalities embodying facets of divine glory. Since I move about with you, eat like you, and talk with you, you are deluded into the belief that this is but an instance of common humanity. Be warned against this mistake. I am also deluding you by my singing with you, talking with you, and engaging myself in activities with you. But any moment, my divinity may be revealed to you. You have to be ready, prepared for that moment, since divinity is enveloped by humanness. You must endeavor to overcome the Maya delusion that hides it from your eyes. This is a human form in which every divine entity, every divine principle, that is to say, all the names and forms ascribed by man to God, are manifest. How fortunate you are that you can witness all the countries of the world paying homage to Bharata, India. You can hear adoration of Satya Sai's name reverberating throughout the world, even while this body is existing, not at some future date, but when it is with you, before you. Rama and Krishna and Sai Baba appear different because of the dress each has donned, but it is the self-same entity, believe me. Do not be misled into error and loss. The time will soon come when this huge building, or even vaster ones, will be too small for the gatherings of those who are called to this place. The sky itself will have to be the roof of the auditorium of the future. I will have to forego the car and even the airplane when I move from place to place, for the crowds pressing around will then be too huge. I will have to move across the sky. Yes, that too will happen. Believe me." End quote. The four of us gathered around him, all sort of hunched over and wearing big grins. It was obvious that we were hiding something. The headlights bore down on us and seemed to be taking an awfully long time to get there, while we clamored over each other like cattle, until we could see that it was only a truck. The drivers hardly bothered to look our way. I'm sure if they had, they'd have stopped just to see what we were hiding. Baba had been smiling the whole time, apparently enjoying the play very much. On the way back to the car, my brother was about to step into a pile of dung when Baba playfully grabbed his arm and pulled him to safety. "Cow dung," he said, pointing down. then proceeding to give us a short lesson on the correct pronunciation of cow dung in Telugu. We were all laughing when we reached the car. Then again, in his play, as if he didn't know, Baba asked the number of children in our families, only to give us another glimpse of his infinite knowledge as he created 6 beautiful little silver medals, one for each child, with a swirl of his hand. As we started off again, Baba resumed his chiding of the driver, and for the most part the conversation was light, but we touched on some deeper subjects as well. To a question about economic inflation and depression, Baba answered, quote, "Not until man learns to value mankind will anything else find its proper value. There will be a time of unrest and change in the world, a time when mankind will turn more toward the spiritual for guidance." Baba, I asked, will your message be known throughout the world? He said, "Not soon, slowly. It will be hard for people to understand my message. It will only come about slowly." End quote. "When will you come to America?" I asked. Quote, "Before one can go out to others, he has to put his own home in order. And some gurus have given the Indian holy man a questionable reputation. But I will come. I will come. And I am always with you. Always. Always. Always." End quote. As we approached the entrance to the ashram grounds, he turned to us and said, quote, "It has been your good fortune to spend this time with me. Remember when you are back home, remember this experience. It will be meditation for you." End quote. It was 8 o'clock in the evening, and my brother and I would have to depart the next morning. Baba invited us into a private room. I felt that perhaps this very special ride marked the beginning of a more personal relationship with him. In spite of all my earlier rationalizings to the contrary, I asked him if I could come live by him. Quote, "It is only in your imagination that there is a distance," end quote, was his patient reply. He allowed me to place my forehead on his lotus feet, and I left. Good news about the presence of Sai Baba among us will spread quickly throughout the world, I am sure, even though, as he says, it will take a while for us to comprehend his full significance or the meaning of his message. It has been my good fortune to draw close to him at a time when it is still possible to become friendly with him on a personal level and see the clear signs of his greatness in a close and intimate way. Yet I feel that soon Baba will become but an orange speck on the horizon, surrounded by millions of eager faces, and like the people in his village who are once blessed to know the sweetness of his being from daily personal contact with him, I too will one day be saddened by having to view him only from a distance. But it is enough to know that Sai Baba exists at all. I feel deeply fortunate to be able to play a part in some small measure through this book in an evolutionary phenomenon moving inexorably toward realization. World consciousness awakening to its own glorious potential and to the presence of a being who may indeed be ushering in a golden age. The book ends with the following quotation from Satya Sai Baba, quote, "Be simple and sincere. It is sheer waste of money to burden the pictures and idols in the shrines and altars of your homes with a weight of garlands, and to parade costly utensils and vessels and offerings to show off your devotion. This is deception. It demeans divinity, imputing to it the desire for pomp and publicity. I ask only for purity of heart to shower grace. Do not posit distance between you and me. Do not interpose the formalities of the guru-friend relationship or even the attitudinal distinctions of the God-devotee relationship between you and me. I am neither guru nor God. I am you. You are I. That is the truth. There is no distinction. That which appears so is the delusion. You are waves. I am the ocean. Know this and be free. Be divine." End quote. This concludes the reading of Sai Baba, The Holy Man and the Psychiatrist. Thank you.